Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the show. This is Reservations, and I'm Rain Whalen.
And I'm Demetrius Cornhole. There it is.
I feel like you used the cornhole. No. I don't know. That sounds vaguely familiar, but...
Not on this list.
Maybe I'm Mandela affecting myself because you've had so many strange names over these seasons.
Yeah.
There was a name I was going to say.
I need to come up with more because I'm almost completely out. So.
Yeah. Okay. And as we just did our backtracking, there's still 8 more episodes this season. Well, 9.
And I don't have that many names on the list still, so I need to come up with some other ones.
Yeah, 9 including the bonus episodes. So. Right. Anyways.
Right.
Well, welcome back, everyone. Excuse me. I'm drinking a Baja Blast, so I'm very burpy now.
Jesus.
Welcome back, everyone. This is the first episode since I've been back from Disney, which, I mean, I've been back since the previous episode came out. Disney was rad, man. And yeah, cool. As I was telling you off mic, we almost didn't make it back.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have been interesting. I don't know what it would have done. I guess just like find someone new, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, but you don't have all the passwords to everything.
You're absolutely right. I don't know what I would have done. Like, listen, man, we're just going to have to start from scratch. I don't know. he does everything. I just show up, you know?
Well, and if anyone can see, if you're watching the video, I'm wearing one of the shirts I got at Disney, a Kermit the Frog shirt.
Kermit the Frog.
Of Kermit looking, as we were talking about off mic, this shirt is just so funny because he's sitting on a stool with his fingers crossed, almost like he's either A, about to release the hardest mixtape we've ever heard, or B, that he's about to give us a very, like, I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed kind of talk.
Yeah, he seems disappointed for sure.
And it's just, it's so funny to me because this, we saw this at not one, but at least 3 different gift shops around the Magic Kingdom park. And I'm like,
but
what
it's just
the
Magic Kingdom.
Yeah. Like, I didn't see it at Hollywood Studios where the Muppets have an actual presence there. Yeah. So I was like, why is this one Kermit the Frog shirt? At like, what's the point? And it made me laugh, so I told Ashley, like, I have to get it. I'm sorry.
You know, but this brings up a good point, and it's movie related, which is good because that's what we do here on the show. Is, you know, that people just need to, we need to like do something to have the Muppets be put back into movies, right? Because they're actors. Uh-huh. Right? And so
yeah,
like,
of course.
Like, I saw one, and there are plenty of examples out there, but there's one that's like, do a Knives Out, but everyone's a Muppet except for
Benoit Blanc. Yeah.
Like, do another one, but it's just Muppets. Right?
You know, I see. Okay. Hang on, everyone. This is why another reason why I love Jason Segel is the fact that he did bring the Muppets back.
He did, but not in the way we want. I want a themed Muppets movie. I want Muppet Saving Private Ryan. You know what I mean? Or
you mean like in Cats Don't Dance at the very end when they're doing like those versions of like
exactly
the Mask, but with Muppets.
That's exactly what I want. The Witches of Eastwick. Yeah, that's exactly what I want. Except with, like, you know, I want, like...
You know what? Since we were already talking about it, let's just do a Lost Highway, but it's Muppets.
But it's Muppets. It's, like, Irreversible, but it's Muppets. Like, yeah. I completely... Like, I want, like...
Wait, like, really, hang on.
Like, really earnest, like, recreations of these films, but with Muppets. You know? That's what I want.
I'm sending you a meme for the Irreversible. Future Rain will not put it on screen, but I need to see your reaction on camera.
Yeah, like, that's what I want. I want, like, and so I saw a video where it was like on TikTok, and someone was saying, like, dude, I would watch like The Bachelor if it was Muppets. You know what I mean? Like, I would watch like The Bachelorette, but it was Miss Piggy, and she's like, but all the dudes are humans, you know? Oh, there we go. Oh my God. That's good. That's what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. But it's Muppet. You know?
Man.
So I think Hollywood should get back to Muppifying these intellectual properties. That's what I'm saying.
I mean, look. I still haven't watched it, but the Electric Mayhem show I heard was really good.
Sure.
I mean, because we need justice for Dr. Teeth. Ashley and I were listening to like a Spotify playlist that had a bunch of Disney songs on it last night, and it started playing a Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem.
Nice.
And I knew it immediately because I love the Muppets. And Ashley was like, what the fuck is this? And I'm like, this is Dr. Teeth in the Electric Mayhem. Show him some respect.
Yeah, show some respect, bro.
Also, one final thing about the Muppets, and we'll get on with the
episode. We'll move on.
So in Hollywood Studios at Disney World in Florida, I'm going to stress Florida because I've been telling people that I just got back from Disney, and they're like, oh, California or... Disney World in Florida, in Hollywood Studios, in the Muppets area. And it's small. Like, the Muppets area, truth be told, it's a little disrespectful. It's a corner. It's literally a corner of Hollywood Studios. They have one giant theater where you can see Muppet Vision 3D, which is, it's one of those where you sit in the theater, you put on 3D glasses, but then they have, like, you know, they have, like, little, like spurts of air, so when things like whiz by you, they have a Miss Piggy statue, fountain that looks like Miss Piggy is the Statue of Liberty. And that's pretty much it. I mean, like, you can still walk down, but like that's all it is. So yeah. I'm hoping Disney will maybe expand on that. They were working on something while we were there in the Muppets area, but anyway, I'm really disappointed in this. So they have a restaurant in that area, Rizzo's Pizzeria. And if anyone doesn't know, Rizzo is one of the best characters ever. And when Ashley and I were at Hollywood Studios, we're like, you know, we really want pizza. And yeah. I was like, well, hey, I remember seeing Rizzo's Pizzeria. Like, let's go have that. And she's like, bet. They fucking close at 5. So damn, we get over there at 5. Yeah, at 5:30. We got there. And we're like, huh, that's weird. The doors are locked. And we looked it up because you can look at like the restaurants and stuff.
Yeah.
On the app. And yes, they closed at 5.
And Rizzo's the best part of Muppet Christmas Carol for sure.
Oh, when Gonzo wipes the window with him.
Yeah.
Thank you for making me a part of this.
Honestly, just the whole ride, he's just like happy to be there. You know, he's just like, whatever.
Yeah, dude, Rizzo's the best.
I agree.
And his friendship with Gonzo is A1. Yeah. But we're not talking about that movie today. Jeremy, what are we talking about today?
All right. So today, we are discussing Joel Coen's adaptation of Shakespeare's Macbeth.
Well, what's the full title?
The Tragedy of Macbeth. You nailed it.
There you go. Yeah. Sidebar, I looked up, because I wanted a lot of information going into this episode. I just find it so interesting. Back in when the play was originally written, tragedy wasn't spelled with an E-Y. It was spelled... I'm not going to spell the whole thing because I always misspell tragedy, but it ends with D-I-E.
Interesting.
And I was just like, that's just interesting. Yeah, anyway, just a little fun fact to get the ball rolling. But, dude, I was so excited when you put this on your list, because You put this on later, right?
I took something off, yeah, to make room, because I remembered, like, I was going through my list, and I was like, you know what, like, I've been wanting to rewatch it. I'm like, oh, what a great opportunity to rewatch, and then get to talk about it, you know, because, so full disclosure, I have never read Macbeth, nor have I seen any other adaptation of it.
Same.
So, okay. So I knew nothing, right? Normally something like this would just bore me, right? Like, I know Kenneth Branagh is an amazing filmmaker, right? Mm-hmm. And I know he's done a lot of Shakespeare adaptations. And I know he got an Oscar for Hamlet. Mm-hmm. And I just don't care at all. I just don't, you know, and it's, but this, when I saw the trailer for this, it immediately grabbed my attention. I was captivated by the imagery. And of course it's Joel Coen, you know, of Coen Brothers fame, of Raising Arizona fame. And, you know, it's got Denzel, it's got Frances McDormand. So I was like, all right, you know, like I'm in, they're going to do the traditional old English. They're going to do it verbatim, which is interesting, but it looks like the presentation is going to be different. And I can't tell you, I mean, I will, because we'll talk about it, but it's hard to describe just how cool I think it looks, to, you know, not put it very elegantly, but I just think it just looks so cool, and it feels so different and so disconnected from the source material, yet it's completely, I don't know, it seems disconnected from the source material, yet it is, of course, paying so much respect and it's so much love and care for the source material. So we'll talk about all of it, of course, because the visuals and how everything is put together and how it's presented to you is so much of what is going on here, what makes it so good. But you go ahead with your first impressions.
Yeah. So this was technically a first watch. Mm-hmm. I, just like yourself, as soon as I saw the trailer, I was sold.
Yeah.
And then doubly sold when I realized it was Joel Coen. I was a little like, well, wait, where's Ethan?
Yeah.
But yeah, I was sold almost instantly. And when it came out, I was one of the few times I was like, I'm so glad I have Apple TV Plus. Let's go.
Same.
I have started this movie twice and never finished it either time. This was the first time I've watched it from start to finish. And the reason being, because like yourself, I've never read Macbeth. I've never seen any other adaptation. Yes, technically we could count The Lion King as an adaptation of Hamlet.
Sure.
But I've never really seen any other, like, actual screen adaptation of a Shakespeare play. And I'm going to draw a lot of comparisons to this one, except for Baz Luhrmann's Romeo plus Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
Which, just like this movie, uses the verbatim old English.
Yeah, the text, yeah. It's verbatim.
But rather than what they didn't do that they do with this movie that Baz did, which is set it in modern times. But anyway. Mm-hmm. And all I really know about the stage play of Macbeth is, of course, all the legends surrounding it. That it's the cursed play, that you don't say the name of the play unless, of course, it's during the play. You don't speak the name Macbeth, and you know, so I always found that very fascinating. But I think the reason why I started this movie twice, didn't finish it, was because I knew almost right off the bat it was a very dense film that required all of my attention. It wasn't, I mean, like, I do pay attention when I watch films, but sometimes I'm maybe fidgeting with stuff or you know, looking at trivia on my phone or, you know, something.
Yeah.
But I'm still paying attention. But I knew almost immediately, like, oh, this requires me to put all distractions aside and pay attention. And and I can do that no problem, but I don't know. There's just something that I was like, okay, no, I need to stop right here. I'll pick it back up. And then I picked it back up. I'm like, I need to restart it. Restarted it. And so, yeah. So that's another reason why I'm glad you picked it, because it forced me to actually sit and finish the film. So this is a long-winded explanation to say that it was awesome. And I think you're right. I think cool is the best way to describe it, because it was very cool. And also,
it really is. I need to find a better way to say it. But yeah, no, I know what you mean.
Yeah. I mean, and compared to two of the other films that we've done from Joel Cohen, Inside Llewyn Davis, and of course our 100th episode special, Big Lebowski. Shout out to those episodes. Go check them out. Sidebar, speaking about our 100th episode, I think we're approaching our 200th episode fairly soon.
How exciting.
So we may need to discuss
especially a
big one for that. Yeah, because we're on 193 now. So
oof, we're getting there. Getting close.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll discuss it.
Yeah. But anyway, but you know, this one was so different in terms of visual style.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. It everything I read said that like Joel wanted to respect the original source material. And of course, we'll get into it, but this isn't the first time Macbeth has been adapted into film.
No.
There have been a plethora of adaptations. The most recent one that comes to mind is the one with Michael Fassbender and Marion Cotillard. How do you say her last name?
I don't know. It's French.
I never saw that. Yeah, I never saw that one. I wanted to. I heard it didn't do very well, but I still wanted to see it because it's Fassbender, you know.
Yeah, that one I was interested in as well. I tried to do a little bit of something. I watched the trailer for it, and it seems more of a epic, right? More of a you know, larger scale, where like it just seems bigger, right?
Okay.
Every film you've ever seen up until now seems bigger compared to this one, right? And that's, of course, completely on purpose. This one is, I may use it too much. Hopefully we won't have a counter going. But this one is restrained, right? It's almost like it's keeping itself from being those things, right? Because
too grandiose.
Right, because what Cohen is trying to do here is he is, instead of making the setting and the scenery and the look of the film be the foreground, he wants the performances and the words and the actual text to be the foreground, right?
Mm-hmm.
He wants to push everything else back, which he does incredibly, right? Doing it in black and white right off the bat will bring the text and the performances forward because you're less distracted by things around you, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what he's doing here is well far and beyond just, you know, setting it in black and white, you know, and stripping things down a little bit. He has stripped everything away, right? Mm-hmm. Every set is flat. And either like is a long corridor or is like this very cramped space, yet the ceilings seem to go on forever. He gives you an idea of a castle, but he doesn't show you the castle, right? There's fog outside, so you can't see the plains of the Scottish countryside. If it's outside, it doesn't really feel like it's outside, right? We're still confined in a precise space, right? So he's, what he's doing is he's keeping with the tradition of a play, right? He wants mm-hmm. you to feel like you're watching a staged performance, because technically it is. Everything was shot on a soundstage. So mm-hmm. it feels like a theatrical performance. Yet it's still a film. And so they're doing things that, of course, you can't do with theatrical performances, like close-ups, for instance. Right?
Right.
So that feels pretty genuinely, traditionally thematic with filmmaking, right? But then, of course, the setting is nothing like what you've seen in film before. But it is something you might have seen on stage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the choice to strip everything down to its bare minimum is ambitious, and I think it pays off in a huge way, because he's also using lighting in such a unique way where it's so dramatic and it's so contrasting. That's not a word, but it's so dynamic. So it may be why I love it so much is it harkens back to a film noir and German expressionism. There were times mm-hmm. where there are shadows literally painted on the set in this film.
Yeah.
Which is German Expressionism, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. So before we go on, just in case anyone doesn't know, we'll give the briefest of synopsises, and then I want to circle back to your German Expressionism.
You go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a quick little synopsis in case you don't know anything about the play Macbeth. I mean, it's over, what, four... 1-2 years, 100 years, whatever years old. Hang on, everyone, shut up.
Wow, you're looking it up for real. All right.
Holy fuck. Yeah, it's over 400 years old.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. Over 400 year old play written by William Shakespeare tells the story of Macbeth, who is a thane, which I assume is a lord. And he is in the line of succession to become king. He receives a prophecy that he will become king, and through means of ambition, seizes the throne by killing the king in place, Malcolm. And out of fear, Malcolm's son flees, so that only leaves Macbeth.
Sorry, Duncan. Malcolm is the son.
That's right. I flipped him. My bad. Okay. Malcolm flees. So that leaves the opening for Macbeth to step up. But through paranoia and probably a little guilt, which we'll get to, he begins to unravel. He becomes a tyrant. He kills anyone in his way, from seizing the crown from him. And it ultimately culminates in a new prophecy, from the Weird Sisters, which I forgot to mention, but we'll talk about more, that essentially his reign will end regardless. And it does almost spectacularly, because he was just so blind by his own greed and ambition, which had a little bit to do with his wife, which we'll also get to. And he's ultimately beheaded, and Malcolm becomes the rightful king of Scotland. And that's Macbeth.
Yeah, essentially, yeah. In a nutshell.
Yeah.
So
circling back to your German expressionism, because I think that's a great place to start.
Probably why I'm so drawn to it, because I love that style and I love just how dynamic it all looks, and it is very theatrical in the way that it was set up, because again, it's, you know, in the German expressionism days of silent film, you have to build these sets, and it does sort of look like, you know, something you would see at the theater, right?
We'll see. So I'm glad you said that, because after I finished the film, which I technically finished it today, I wanted to find behind the scenes. I wanted to find something. And thankfully, Apple TV did have sort of a bonus 13-minute behind the scenes look. And they talked about the sets. And one of the set, I believe one of the set designers said, like, Joel was really wanting sort of a German expressionistic style, to the point where the sets were black and white. Literally everything was black and white. The cinematographer said there was no color on set at all. Costumes were not in color.
Yeah.
Except for maybe one of Francis's dresses. But other than that, everything was in black and white. And I just found that so interesting. But at the same time, what you said, it makes sense that Joel would strip everything back. And
well, it's even an interesting choice to do it that way, you know, because I think we've seen, not we obviously as in you and I, but audiences have sort of come to expect a grandiose sort of retelling of these plays, because they're, it's so easy to do that with film. It's so easy to go, well, since I have the opportunity, let's go ahead and let's shoot a battle scene, right? Let's go ahead and like have the forest move in a very big way, right? Let's have the final battle between Macduff and Macbeth be this big epic, you know, battle. And I think that stripping it down, subverting our expectations, and just saying, here's everything you need for it to work and nothing else, right? It's such an interesting way to do it. And I think that you almost have a more appreciation for the text and for the story with everything else being so pulled back, right? And withheld from you. Because there are moments where I think if this were a big production, you know, that shelled out hundreds of millions of dollars to, you know, tell me the story, I don't think I would get it as much, you know, maybe. I don't know. I still found it sort of hard to follow, if I'm being honest, because it's the text, right? The words are hard to follow.
No, I agree. I agree. Because there were times where I was like, what are they even talking about right now? But, and again, but like I said, attention. I was paying attention. And this kind of, and again, like I said, I was going to make comparisons to Romeo plus Juliet because of the same thing, since Boz decided to use the text, the old English in that film, but put it in a modern setting. It was easy to draw context clues as to what they were talking about. This one was a little harder, but it was, I think it was because, you know, Joel said it in the time period that it was set in for the play. But again, you could still use context clues to infer what they're talking about.
And again, there's nothing to distract you, right? And again, I'm not saying that he's doing this as sort of a teaching tool. He's not doing it to say,
No. I agree.
To say you're not paying attention, but I'm going to make you pay attention. That's not what he's doing. He's just giving you another interpretation, right? A more theatrical interpretation and a minimalist interpretation, which I really liked, right? What he does with the witches, okay?
Oh, dude. With shout out to Catherine Hunter.
Catherine Hunter, as some of you may not know, is a contortionist. And what she can do with her body is remarkable because, okay, so you have that tip of that finger, and instead of putting it in her palm, she put it on the top of her hand and curled her hand up to hold it in place. Blew my mind. And I know that's not CGI. I know she can actually do stuff like that, right? The way she's moving her arms and she's contorting her body, and she's representing all three of them. And the way that Cohen like shows three of them first in the puddle for the other two, and then the fog brings them to the surface, I thought was just incredible. And what a great way to start off this movie, right? Mm-hmm. With the prophecy, of course. But I like that we get all of this information before the title card even is shown, mm-hmm. right? It's just remarkable. And my cats were obsessed with the birds. They were like, I guess because it's black and white, maybe they're able to like pay attention more, because with the birds circling around the screen, they were just captivated and about to jump onto the TV. But yeah, again, Catherine Hunter, MVP of the film. I think she's incredible because she also plays the old man as well.
Yeah. And if anyone doesn't know who she is, if you've seen the lesser Harry Potter film, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, she's Miss Fig,
yeah.
who finds Harry after he casts his Expecto Patronum in front of Dudley.
Yeah, it's a Patronum.
She only has two scenes in that movie, but she does great. Great job.
She's also in Poor Things.
Oh, that's right. So, which I haven't seen.
She's amazing in Poor Things. She's amazing in everything. She's amazing. Again, well, she brings such visceral uncanniness to her characters, that because she herself is sort of uncanny, right? She herself mm-hmm. is sort of bizarre and doesn't feel based in reality, right? But mm-hmm. neither does this entire film. So it works perfectly because the entire film is sort of untethered from reality. You're sort of in a dreamlike state at all times. I think it's just because you can't get your bearings. Right.
Well, and I also should point out, because I don't want it to be an oops, I forgot. The actual film starts with one of our favorite
character
actors.
Yes.
Ralph Ineson, also the Green Knight.
Yeah.
Because he did this after he did The Green Knight, which when I first showed Ashley the trailer, which I know I mentioned last week, when I first showed Ashley the trailer, we had just seen The Green Knight with you and Alex, mm-hmm. and she was like, wow, is E24 just like doing this like medieval thing? And then when Catherine does her whole by the pricking of my thumb, she was like, oh, I know what this is now.
Yeah.
But yeah, but I just wanted to point that out because, yeah, I forgot he was in it because, like I said, I'd started this film twice already.
Right.
And so I forgot that he technically starts us on this,
you're right,
on this journey. And then I was just like, you know, it's just so funny that Joel would start the film technically with him,
mm-hmm.
considering he's also I don't want to say plot device for the Green Knight, but he is for me. He's our plot device for the Green Knight. So,
yeah, I mean, the performances in this, no one is phoning anything in. No one is giving any sort of like less than performance. Everybody is doing a tremendous job. I would say, you know, it's Catherine Hunter, of course, would be probably my favorite performance in the film. But I mean, Denzel, I mean, you can't beat Denzel's performance. And Frances McDormand. Dude. I think they're neck and neck when it comes to just outshining one another. They just are so captivating. And she especially is extremely captivating.
You know, we could probably spend a million hours talking about their performances. But like in that bonus content, they interviewed the casting director, and she was saying how like, they were going to have, you know, Frances playing Lady Macbeth. But they're like, you know, we needed to find someone who, one, was classically trained,
mm-hmm.
and two, could hold their own with Frances. And she was like, you know, that became a very short list, but Denzel was at the top of that list. Yeah. And
I know. Yeah, I completely agree. He's incredible. Not something I think I wouldn't say general audiences, because this movie's not for really general audiences, not necessarily, right? Because it's on Apple TV Plus, which not everybody has. It's an A24 film, which is already sort of gonna not bring in a general audience member. But then it's Shakespeare, which is also going to, you know, tether some people away. But I think if general audiences saw this movie and like the average moviegoer saw it, I think it would subvert their expectations of Denzel, because they don't associate Denzel with Shakespeare, even though he's done it before.
I remember seeing an interview, I think it was with Colbert, where he was talking about, you know, having trained in Shakespearean plays, and so getting to do this was sort of like how he started his career on in acting. And man, and Denzel just like, it's such a, I don't want to say subtle, but it almost kind of is. It is such a subtle performance.
I mean, he's not doing his, you know, he's not doing a big bombastic performance like we would see in like American Gangster or Man on Fire or anything like that. He's not doing anything like that. He is sort of restrained a little bit. And again, because this movie just withholds, right?
Mm-hmm.
In a great way. This isn't to say that it's, you know, withholding greatness. It is great, and it's because it's withholding things from you, right?
And then we can move to Frances McDormand, and she's outstanding. You know, I still need to see Three Billboards Outside of Ewing.
Yeah.
Especially because, you know, that's I can't think of his name.
Yeah.
The writer director.
Yeah.
Martin McDonough.
Yeah.
McDonough or whatever. But yeah, she's just,
it was funny, is my wife, we were watching it the first time when it came out a few years ago. We were watching on the couch, and my wife is like, "Oh, she's gonna start washing her hands." And I turned to her, I go, "You know the story?" She's like, "Yeah, I paid attention in English class." I go, "It wasn't even an option in my English class to read Macbeth." But I was stoked. Yeah, I was like, "Cool, can you tell me what's going on?"
We read Animal Farm in my English class at Midland High.
We watched a lot of movies. My English class.
For as short as he's in the film, I also want to just praise Brendan Gleeson. I love him so much. And he is just, he's so fantastic as Duncan.
Yeah.
And again, as we've been saying, as it's just this really pulled back performance as a king, which also makes it all the more so shocking when Macbeth kills him, because Duncan, for what little screen time he hasn't really shown that he's a bad king or a terrible person in any way.
No.
And Macbeth just...
Well, he has to fulfill that prophecy, right?
Yeah.
Because he was already, because it was a double prophecy. It was one that he was going to rise the ranks to like second in command or something, right? And then he gets it, right? Almost immediately upon his return to Duncan. Duncan promotes him to second
command. Yeah. Ross, Alex Hassel, or as many people may know him, was it Translucent from The Boys?
Yeah.
Hang on, I'm looking it up. Everyone shut. Shut up. I'm pretty sure it was Translucent. Yeah, Translucent. Even though he was in three episodes. But yeah. Yeah, he's promoted almost instantly to the Thane of Cawdor. And then Duncan promotes his son to Prince of Cumberland, So his son really is next in line. And that's what then presents the first issue of, well, the weird sister said, I was going to be next. So how are we going to make this work? And also, you know, shout out to Harry Melling, also another Harry Potter alum, Cousin Dudley, who we also praised his performance in The Devil All the Time. He also phenomenal. Everyone's performance in this film was phenomenal. But anyway, you know, and it's so interesting that, like you said, like as soon as he gets that prophecy, it's almost immediate. And I love how quickly it just kind of snowballs.
The story happens pretty quickly. I mean, everything goes and hits beats in very quick succession. There's really no lag. There are no scenes in there that feel like filler by any means. Again, I'm not sure how accurate this is to a traditional story, the traditional story of Macbeth. I don't know. I don't know if he's cutting things out. Again, I can appreciate the set design, the overall look and feel and tone of the film, and I can appreciate the three sisters as being different, right? I know those things are different. I'm not sure how different the story is, right? If he has changed or omitted anything, I don't know, right?
That is a good question. I mean, as we've already established, I can't answer that either.
I don't know I thought you had seen or read Macbeth. I don't know why I assumed that going forward.
I mean,
but that's fine.
I would assume that things were probably cut for time.
Maybe. I mean, Joel... it's an hour and 45 minutes. I don't know how long the play is supposed to last. It can't be that long. People have to perform this thing, right?
Yeah, here, let's see.
We left to perform it like night after night, you know, so it can't be that long. But again, maybe again omitting like battle sequences, but then again, like you can't do that on stage either. So how dull would that be to watch? Like a battle sequence on stage? I would find that very dull. But again, like I said, I can't speak to that, but I can speak to what I feel is different. And I was going through some of the reviews on Amazon, not on Amazon, on IMDb, and one of them was so egregious because the title of the review was "Nothing New," and I was like, "Everything's new."
Yeah,
everything about this telling of Macbeth is different, except for the story. Maybe, I don't know.
Sidebar. So sure. the play, because I was curious, according to when it's been on Broadway, now this may not be the actual run of when it was first in the 1600s, but according to when it was on Broadway, it was 2 hours and 20 minutes with one intermission.
A little short. I'm not sure.
So about 45 minutes cut out, essentially.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Again, who knows where that is or where that, you know, because there are things that film can do that's faster, right? I guess we're doing this. So just real fast. So you could argue that changing sets and things like that, that takes time also, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Like the actual physical act of changing a set takes time, right? You have to dim the lights, you have to move the set, you have to bring a set in, so that takes time. So let's assume that not a lot has been cut out, okay?
Okay, I'm fine with that.
Let's also assume that no matter what was cut out, everything important, everything that is driven by the main story and the main plot is left in, okay? Then I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
And again, so, I wish I could speak to what he changed, if anything, in the story.
If anyone knows, let us know.
Yeah,
because I meant to say this at the top of the show, but Stormy actually responded to
did she
on Spotify our when our episodes are posted on Spotify, there's actually a Q&A where it says, "What do you think of the episode?" Uh-huh. And she responded. So if anyone listens to us on Spotify, you know, just answer that quick question. If you know,
please,
what was cut out, or if you follow us on Facebook or you watch us on YouTube, let us know.
I'd love to know. I'm sure like maybe there's something like super important that was left out and they're screaming and yelling at us right now.
So back to your egregious review, the whole nothing new.
It's a nothing new.
Yeah, that's...
And I couldn't believe it because I'm like, did you not watch the same movie? Because everything is new. What he is doing here is so unique and so subversive and just, it is new, right? It's a new interpretation of this story that, yes, the dialogue is the same. I'll give you that. Mm-hmm. I'll give you the dialogue. The story's the same. Right? I'll give you that too. That of course is, they're not going to change the story.
Yeah, exactly.
Macbeth is not going to survive at the end of this thing. He's not going to defeat Macduff. It's not going to happen. Right?
Yeah. He's not going to skate down on a skateboard and flick a lit cigarette at someone and be like, I'm the true king of Scotland.
Exactly. That's not going to happen. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, even in Romeo plus Juliet, besides its modern setting, mm-hmm. it still plays out exactly like the play does.
Exactly. So to they say that there's nothing new though. Is insane, because it's absolutely not true. But
yeah, and it's also new for Joel. You know, this is new territory that we haven't seen him in, you know, of adapting.
Again, such a surprise, because if you were to look at the past filmography of the two of them, you're not expecting this at all. Right? Mm-hmm. I'm not expecting the movie to look like this. I'm not expecting him to take so much from German Expressionism, from film noir, and I think the most, which I haven't talked about yet, but the most notable piece of work that he is borrowing from is The Passion of Joan of Arc from 1928, mm-hmm. Which, if you haven't seen, please do yourself a favor, because it is a tremendous piece of filmmaking.
It's amazing. It's on my wish list. Since I have, as we were talking about off mic, since I have this gap now.
Yeah. You
might need to get,
like, it's completely worth your time. It's shot predominantly in close-ups. Which is amazing, because you can really see the performances in their faces, and it's amazing. I can't pronounce her name, but she plays Joan of Arc, and she's amazing. She's incredible, and the performances is incredible, but it looks exactly like this, right?
And I also read Seventh Seal was another... Mm-hmm. bit of inspiration.
It doesn't it feel like when you were watching it, I don't know how familiar you are with Bergman, but it felt like Bergman. It also kind of felt like Tarkovsky too, a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, we did Hour of the Wolf.
Well, that's right.
Which I do, I on my wish list, I do have Bergman's Cinema, the Criterion, that giant one. Set. I know, dude. It's so much money.
$200.
Here, let me see. Let me look at my wish list I've got.
It felt like that, right?
It's $150 bucks.
Jesus. It felt like Bergman. It felt like Tarkovsky. And it definitely feels like The Passion of Joan of Arc, right?
Yeah, and I was reading more about the overall look of the film, and I fully agree with it. Is that they wanted it to feel like it was something, I think they said unearthed. Like it was almost like, hang on. I'm worried. I'm butchering.
It's definitely disconnected from maybe from the earth or from reality. or from any sort of discernible space or time, because outside is either completely shrouded in darkness or it's completely shrouded in fog. Right. So you really can't see it.
Yeah. They wanted it to look like it was unearthed from reality.
Yeah, because, and you can totally tell because there's also lighting that doesn't really make logical sense also in this. And there's, again, the walls and the ceiling seem impossibly too high. And the corridors seem too long. And the just stripping it of any sort of character just makes it feel sort of uncanny. And so when things that are also uncanny start happening, like the water appearing and disappearing from the room that Macbeth is in when the three sisters are talking to him again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just seems to fit because nothing else seems real anyway, you know?
And also, my dyslexia kicked in. It was actually, they wanted it to feel untethered from reality.
Yeah.
Still, same thing, you know, because it did feel otherworldly.
It does, yeah. Which, again, Catherine Hunter is the perfect casting for.
Oh, 100%.
Because she's in the
yeah.
world. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It, you know, she has a very, to use Willem Dafoe's terminology, she has a very expressive face, and she knows really how to utilize her face to the full. And I think that's why she feels so
in her body, right? Again, like, mm-hmm. I can't get over her performance, and I think she's incredible and she's amazing. And she really got to use her talents of, you know, I don't know if she was an acrobat or if she was the contortionist. I know she's done things like that, but like Cirque du Soleil type stuff before. Like she's done acrobatic stuff, and she really got to use it with this performance, which is cool because she doesn't really get to in the other stuff that I've seen her in. So it was neat to be able to see all the stuff she can do and how it fits so well within the story and within her character.
Well, and you know, and she also also has, you know, been a you know, a stage performer as well. You know, mm-hmm. she, like, I know, I'm sure someone out there is going to roll their eyes, but you know, if you pull her up on Wikipedia, for example, her picture is her performing as Richard III at the Globe. So she's, you know, so I'm sure this was sort of like a breath of fresh air where she gets to kind of, as we've been saying, since Joel stripped it back almost as a stage play, I'm sure she felt very comfortable and very at home with something that wasn't so big and so like, oh, we have all this money. Let's, you know.
Yeah, again, the idea to shoot it all on a soundstage, even the stuff that is, quote, outdoors, makes it feel still more confined, even though they're not explicitly telling you that it's in a confined space.
You know, well, you know what that kind of reminded me of a little bit? It reminded me of what we discussed at our Crow and Dark City episodes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it certain times it felt like there was a ceiling.
The ceiling, yeah.
Except for the few times where we have a shot that's looking straight up and we can see the clouds moving through. And like with the, when the weird sisters visit Macbeth again, you know, and as I learned in that bonus content, is that's one of the few shots that has CGI, is because they had Catherine up there and there was a ceiling and then they CGI'd the sky. But it's so seamless. Like, it's,
oh yeah, no, you would never know. And I assumed they're doing a lot of editing and just taking things out, I assume, just to make things more slick and more neutral for the set and for, you know, the surrounding whatevers. Right. And of course there's still some shots that are just so amazing and big in scale to an extent, like when he opens the window and all those leaves rush in, right? I know.
Yeah.
I know, right? Like, that scene is gorgeous, and it's just perfect. You know, I don't know how many times I had to do it, but it was incredible to see. And even the scenes with them, with the branches and with like the woods, so it can move. I thought that was really well done, and it seems sort of big in scale, but again, not as it could have been. Mm-hmm. It feels big because everything else is so small, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it was so surprising also to see how many people they were able to get for this film, and then seeing those same people in other projects, like Lady Macduff, for example, Moses Ingram. Mm-hmm. The first thing I ever saw her in was the Obi-Wan Kenobi show on Disney Plus.
Really?
And oh, dude, she crushed it. I mean, didn't you see Obi-Wan?
No,
I thought you did. You did? No. Oh, dude, I think you would like it. Joel Edgerton's back as the young Uncle Owen, you know, for his, you know, the for fact sure. that he only got to play that character twice in the prequel trilogy. But Moses Ingram was in that, and she's fantastic. And as soon as she came on screen in this,
yeah,
I was like, oh my God, that's Moses Ingram.
Stephen Root was a surprise for me. I was like, dude, I forgot he was in it. And I was like, oh, that's right. Stephen Root, dude, he's incredible. Yeah,
and the fact that he face plants so like it's, and I thought I was like that. He for sure, I felt like he for sure nailed that. Like no problems. You know, I just love. I was like, how do they get all these many talented people?
Yeah,
in one movie, you know. It's
I agree. I think it's incredible. And of course, I mean, to be honest, and let's be fair, they saw Joel Cohen, they saw it's a Shakespeare adaptation, and they probably saw Denzel and Francis's names. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like, I'm in, please and thank you. You know? But yeah, I mean, this movie is just incredible, and I'm so happy that people took a chance on it, because on paper it sort of seems odd and it wouldn't work and it's too ambitious, you know, because even like, again, he stole the aspect ratio from Joan of Arc also, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of like, knowing what we know about, sort of just because we've heard so many people talk about it, or we've done deep dives on these certain movies and the process of how it gets made, things like that are sort of deal breakers for studios.
Mm-hmm.
Studio execs seem to think the more niche, or the more risks are being taken with the presentation is bad, right? And so the fact that he's willing to do this in this crazy aspect ratio is crazy, right? And
yeah,
it's amazing that they said yes. And then it's like, oh, and it's going to be in black and white. And I was like, okay. Oh, and we're shooting it all on a soundstage. That's non-negotiable. And it's all going to be super minimalist. And it's like, dude, what are you talking about? You know,
it reminds me of when we did our Mel Brooks series. And he told them that he wanted to make Young Frankenstein, and told them, like, oh, by the way, I want to shoot it in black and white.
Yeah.
And, you know, because right before he'd done that, he did, I don't remember. He'd done Silent Movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember hearing him say on a documentary that they were like, wait, wait, wait. We let you do a film where you took all the sound away. Now you want to take all the color away? And he was like, well, yeah, like, that's what we have to do. You know, but, you know, speaking of the ratio, you know, yeah, I agree. It's studios are less likely to let directors have their aspect ratio the way they want. And I know you're going to roll your eyes at me.
I might.
But I do have to just mention, you know, it is shocking to me that Wes Anderson's been able to get away with that. because he does shoot in some wild aspect ratios.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, you remember when I made you watch Grand Budapest, he goes from a widescreen to a more claustrophobic ratio. And then for the majority of the movie, it's right here.
Yeah.
And the fact that he got the okay for that was insane.
Yeah. You know, it's weird. Over time, it's just these filmmakers that have proven themselves, right? Mm-hmm. So they get to take more risks, and they don't really need to worry about studio interference, because Joel Cohen,
yeah,
he's a Cohen brother. Like, you don't need, he doesn't need permission to do any of this stuff, right? It just,
yeah,
it's still just so amazing that all of it was okay. You know what I mean? Because it needed to be in black and white, because I think in color you would see limitations of shooting everything on a soundstage. You would see the limitations mm-hmm. of having a minimalist set, right? You would see like limitations of having vast nothingness outside of the window. I think if it were in color, you would notice a lot of these flaws, but in black and white, it's just slick and seamless and perfect.
I agree.
Yeah, to where you're not thinking about it. You're not thinking about the vast nothingness outside, right?
Well, and
kind of are, because it's bizarre, but other than that, you know.
Well, and you're right. And a few times I forgot it was on a soundstage. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. I think if it had been in color, we would see those. I don't know why my mind is going to inconsistencies, because that's not the word I'm looking for. But we would see those flaws. There we go. We'd see the flaws in, you know, in maybe like the backdrop that they're using. Kind of like, oh, that's obviously a painted sheet, you know. It's kind of like, I don't know if we talked about it on mic or not, but it's kind of like what I've just recently learned with Disney really using the volume for films.
Mm-hmm.
Because I learned this from my mom, who learned it from the person who actually helped develop the volume, is the more intricate the layout, the harder it's going to be to convince the audience that it's real.
Right.
Like, he told my mom that on Quantumania, Ant-Man and the Lost Quantumania, there was too much, and that's why a lot of people criticized how it looked, because there were moments where certain LEDs weren't working because it was having to process too much simultaneously.
Right.
All that being said, I think that's why the film needs to be in black and white, and why it works so well, is because we're not going to be paying attention to that. And what you said at the top of the show, it's because we're going to be paying attention to the performances.
Right. It brings everything forward.
Mm-hmm.
Everything important forward. Right.
Yes.
I can't get over how it looks. I think it's one of the most interesting looking films. In a good way, in the best way. You're right. This movie feels like Joel Cohen sat down and said, okay, I know Jeremy likes these movies, right? And he loves the aesthetic of these things. I'm going to make a movie that's exactly that, but I'm going to trick him and get him to love a Shakespeare play. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to trick him, and he's going to love it. And it's exactly what he wants to look at, but we're going to sneak in some, you know, AP English, and he'll still love it. And he's right.
All I can think of is that fucking episode in the TED show where he's like, you know, I used to not think anything about these poems till Mrs. B. These poems really are like rappers. Like Joel Cohen going through your letterbox, like, okay.
Oh, Passion Joan of Arc, he gave it 5 stars. Okay. M, 5 stars. Okay, great. What about Metropolis? 5 stars. Okay, great. Hey, we're getting there.
he's yelling at the production assistant from his computer, like, paint the shadows on the walls.
Yeah, he likes that. He's like, ooh, a ghost story. 5 stars. Okay, great. We'll fix that aspect ratio right up. Don't worry about that. All right. Let's, you know.
Oh my God, I forgot about a ghost story.
Well, you know, it's almost like that where it just feels like the movie was perfectly made for me, right? This is one of those. This is one of those films where I turn it on and I am in love. I am in love with this movie. I think it's perfect. I think that the choices that are being made are amazing. I think the performances, of course, are outstanding, right? That's, you know, a given. But again, just the choices that were made aesthetically by how it's supposed to look and what that does to the story is so interesting. And they nailed it. Just everything in this movie is perfect. And they nailed it. And this is how I want all of my Shakespeare to be. Just like,
I agree.
If Joel could do this with Hamlet, with other Midsummer Night's Dream, that's another one. If he can do that with those, I'd watch. 100%. Well, Much Ado About Nothing. There's another one that Denzel was in.
Well, you know, we also, I'm pretty sure this one is on our list for next season.
Yeah, and so is the other one, the Kurosawa one. Spoilers. We're going to do another Kurosawa.
But it's it's on mine. This one right here.
Yeah.
No one can see it, but I know you know what I'm pointing to.
I saw you when you pulled it out. I didn't mean other people know it too, but
I had to make sure that that's what I was thinking it was.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But again, and this also is a good example of just how giving something well-known a different interpretation, right? Which is nothing new for Shakespeare, right? I think popular examples would be like 10 Things I Hate About You, right? That's a retelling of a Shakespeare play, right? Mm-hmm. I think just these really creative ways to retell a story that is very well known is, I don't know, it's very interesting, it's compelling, it's creative, and I love it when people do that. I love it when, like, well, in 10 Things I Hate About You, it's more of, hey, I didn't know that, right? It's more of a, oh, I didn't catch it. But that makes me interested in reading or seeing a traditional telling of the story, right?
Right.
I think in this case, it's more of a, I think it might be more of the same, where it's like, I'm interested now in what it would look like in a different way, or what it would look like in a more maximalist way, in a way, or in a traditional way, not so much this minimalist way, which I find extremely compelling and interesting and beautiful and perfect, that I might not like the other ways that they do it.
Well, I'm gonna admit something to you. I don't know how I fell down this rabbit hole a few years ago, like long before I had this idea for the podcast, but I fell down a rabbit hole of like Shakespeare plays, and I was going to either read or watch adaptations, which was all going to culminate in the film Anonymous, which is, the theorist film that Shakespeare never wrote any of these plays.
Yeah.
And I got like super, it was like my hyper fixation for a good 2 weeks. Cause I was like, I'm going to watch all these films. I'm going to end it with Anonymous. And then I even at some of them, I was like, and I'm going to find like the book. If there's a book, I'm going to read it.
Yeah.
You're
going to solve it. You're going to solve like, is this conspiracy true? Yeah. And
and ask me if I did any of that.
No,
I didn't. Now don't get me wrong, there are still there are still adaptations I'd love to see. You know, like you mentioned, Kenneth Branagh has done at least 3 of them that I know of. I know he did Hamlet. God, I know he did Much Ado About Anything. And I think he did. I think he did King Lear. I don't remember. But yeah, I know he's done at least 3. And I do want to see them. And I agree with you that, you know, maybe stylistically, it may not be my cup of tea. But I'd still like to see it because, again, same as you, this has piqued my interest.
Yeah.
It may not become my hyperfixation again. But for sure, piquing my interest, maybe seeing what else is out there in terms of another artist's adaptation of what Shakespeare's done. Will it top this? I don't think so. I think Joel has set a new... I think he has set a new standard for what you can do with a Shakespeare adaptation.
I agree 100%. You know, sometimes less is more. And I think this is a great example of that.
100%. Yeah. 100%. But, well, Jeremy, are you ready to wrap up?
I am.
I apologize if anyone can hear that.
I am. I think lasting thoughts would be this movie's incredible. If you have an Apple TV Plus subscription, please check it out. If I've piqued your interest with any of the examples I've given, like The Passion of Joan of Arc, please see it. I know in my in the Criterion, you have the option to watch it with no music at all.
Really?
So there are a couple of options for music for accompaniments because it is a silent film. So you get a couple of options, or you get nothing, and you can watch it completely silent. Which I haven't been brave enough to try. I think it might. It might kind of freak me out a little bit. I don't know. Like I wouldn't know. Like, it would just be raw performance, which is really interesting to think about. So I might do it eventually. And we'll probably do it for the show. I can't see a reason why not. I think it's so incredible. So I think people should see it for sure.
Yeah. It's on my wish list. Technically same with Seven Seal, but I want to get that Bergman set.
Yeah. Good luck. Seven Seal is also incredible. So you should see that also.
Yeah. But anyway, so Jeremy, are you ready to hear what we're going to talk about next week?
Yeah.
You're going to be excited, my man, because okay. like I mentioned in our lock episode, we are getting close to the end of the season. I think I've already said it. After this, and including our bonus episode that we've already got planned, we've only got about 9 more episodes left. Now, this one, which of course this is, you're going to immediately know because I told you, this one was supposed to be a surprise for you.
Yeah.
I had told you that we were going to do Mad Max Fury Road, which for sure we will definitely do at a later date.
Eventually.
But then I had the idea that I was going to surprise you with this movie, and I was going to throw you off guard, and I knew you were going to like it anyway, because I know you're a big fan of Aaron Sorkin and Danny Boyle. And then you kind of jumped the gun and picked it for next season. And I had no choice but to tell you, hey, buddy, this was my plan.
Close.
But that's all right. We're still going to do it for this season. So next week, we are going to be discussing Steve Jobs.
Oh man.
Like I just said, was it written by Sorkin and directed by Boyle?
Yes.
Perfect.
Yes. It's one of, so like this film, Tragedy of Macbeth, is an interesting subversive interpretation of something that we are very familiar with, or at least most people are who paid attention in high school. This one, Steve Jobs, is a subversive version of a biopic. It's giving you everything you need to know who these people are, but without doing it in a traditional sense. I think it was Steve Wozniak who, and he might have titled our episode for next. So this is a tease. But he said, none of that happened, but it's all true.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, mm-hmm. realistically, in how the story goes along, it didn't happen that way, but you've captured who these people are and what it was like to know these people, right? And what it was like mm-hmm. to be in those environments and who Steve Jobs was as a person. You nailed it. And even though what happens in the movie didn't happen really like that in real life.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, of course, a lot of people's big complaint was, well, Fassbender doesn't look like Steve Jobs.
It couldn't matter any less. And once you see it, you'll understand.
Yeah. Yeah. If you want a typical biopic of Steve Jobs and you want the actor that looks like him, then go watch the other movie that came out around the same time, Jobs with Ashton Kutcher. I wouldn't recommend it. Sure. It's fine. This is definitely the better of the two films. Mm-hmm. But yeah, man. But I agree. You know, this is still some more tease for next week. I've always read and heard that Steve Jobs was a very intense person. There is a documentary, I believe, about the creation of Pixar, where one of the early founders, I believe, of Pixar talks about how he got in a screaming match with Steve Jobs, because Steve Jobs did technically bankroll Pixar, got them to where they essentially are today. And he was very brave to talk about how he and Steve got into a screaming match over a whiteboard, because apparently Steve had a "don't touch my whiteboard" rule, and this guy finally had enough of Steve's attitude and erased everything on his whiteboard.
Yeah, I heard he had a lot of rules, but who knows? Because it's like, who knows what's fact and what's like lore, you know? Because it's mm-hmm. like, I also heard that people would take the stairs, because if you got caught in an elevator with him and he asked you a question you didn't know the answer, he'd fire you on the spot. You know, it's like, does he have the authority to do that? I mean, maybe, probably, but it's like, so people would just take the stairs because he never did. And so you never had the option to run into him, you know?
Yeah. But I had heard that he was a very intense person, a very great person, but a very intense person.
I don't know. I think some of that is how I feel about method acting. It's sort of like, what are you doing it for? You know, like, you have no reason to be so intense, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, man, Steve Jobs next week.
Can't wait. That's so exciting. Okay. Yeah.
All right, everyone. Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode on The Tragedy of Macbeth, and we will see you next week for Steve Jobs.